Today's scripture reading is from Ephesians 4, verses 11 through 16, and it's on page 944 in the Church Bible. Now these are the gifts Christ gave to the church, the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, and the pastors and teachers. Their responsibility is to equip God's people to do his work and build up the church, the body of Christ. This will continue until we all come to such unity in our faith and knowledge of God's Son that we will be mature in the Lord, measuring up to the full and complete standard of Christ. Then we will no longer be immature like children. We won't be tossed and blown about by every wind of new teaching. We will not be influenced when people try to trick us with lies, so clever they sound like the truth. Instead, we will speak the truth in love, growing in every way more and more like Christ, who is the head of his body, the church. He makes the whole body fit together perfectly. As each part does its own special work, it helps the other parts grow, so that the whole body is healthy and growing and full of love. May the Lord add a blessing to the reading of his word.
So we've been talking about why should you care about biblical leadership? In fact, what should this old book that, depending on who you talk to, varies in date, but still remains old, what does it have to do with biblical leadership? What does it have to do with how we lead as people in the way of Christ, in our communities, in our lives? How does it affect the way we should do things at our church here, or just at organizations in general? Why should you care? I mean, it's an old book. Well, it turns out there's this one line. It shows up in Ephesians, and it says, and he appointed some, or he gifted some to be apostles, some to be teachers, some to be prophets and evangelists. And I think I'm missing one. One to be shepherds. And so a lot of folks look to this one line and say, well, there it is. That's biblical leadership, folks. That's what it's obviously got to be. And as a church, we're taking a second here, taking a pause in our lives and saying, let's take a step back. Let's look at this whole passage and what this whole passage says about what biblical leadership is. What does it say about who we should be today? What does it mean for our church? What does it mean for the big, you know, church around the world, the whole Christian movement? Pause and get notes out. So first, my lovely wife, Stephanie, kicked off this series by introducing this idea of APEST, as we sometimes call it in fancy acronym form, of that the church is composed of diverse leaders that are different from each other, that some have different resonances that resonate with a different way of doing ministry, maybe having a different mission within the Christian movement. Some people resonate more with being an apostle, being a dream awakener. Others resonate with being a prophet, being a heart revealer, revealing what's going on in the hearts of systems and the people around us. Others resonate with being an evangelist or being a shepherd. This is what Stephanie totally resonates with, being a shepherd, of making sure that everyone is on board, that everyone is taken care of, that their soul as well. And there's others like Tony. Okay, Tony is like the teacher. That's like where he goes to, right? He likes to teach, and he wants to tell you about what God's word means for us in our time today. And not just what it means as some abstract thing, but how can we take that and put it into our actions and our words? Right after Stephanie's message was Tony's message about how that even though we've got these diverse leaders who are very, very different from each other all the way, by the way, they aren't all carbon copies of each other like stormtroopers. They're all different from one another. But they're all unified. We are all whole. We are all one church. Even though we as leaders have different missions and different ways about doing about things, we are still one church. We believe in one baptism, one Jesus, and one resurrection. I like to the image that I'm going to pitch before you today about unity, about us being one whole, or us being one whole team here at Grace, is the idea of a paddle team going whitewater river rafting. Has anyone done that before?
Oh,
Aaron, I know I've gone with you several times. And Chris, I'm pretty sure you've done whitewater rafting. Yeah, And Dylan, perfect. So some of you, it's totally fun. And you know, if you haven't done it before, basically, you go to some facility that's like way out in the middle of the woods that have all these cool boats hanging on walls. And then they tell you to put on a wetsuit and put on a life preserver. They give you an oar, and then they tell you to go sit on the ground for like an hour, and you have all these instructors who give these like memorized speeches that are trying to like scare you a bit and get you pumped up, but also kind of scare you a bit from doing anything wrong or falling off the raft, because that actually can be quite dangerous. But then really, people like me are just sitting here going, do 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 do, come on, can't we be rafting yet, do 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 do, and not really listening. But yet, the being on the raft, the experience of all rafting together, I think it encapsulates what it means to be in church. It encapsulates what it means to be at the mercy of the conditions around you. Of all having to work together. Of leadership being something that rests in the guide who's also on the back helping make sure you steer and telling you what to do sometimes. But leadership is all between everyone else on that raft, also a communal resource that's being used. There are times where every single person on the raft has to step up and say, oh, I see this issue going on right now, I'm going to fix it. There have to be moments where you see maybe someone else has gotten thrown off and the guide is like distracted because they're, you know, doing stuff like paying attention to what's going on with the river or the conditions around them. And you have to be like, take charge of the situation and be like, oh, I'm pulling this person in right now. Which, by the way, is a very physically strenuous task. The first time I did, I was like sore for 3 days. You have to like dunk them into the water and then pull up as hard as you can, leaning back into the boat. And they like fall right on top of you, which is a little bit weird for a moment. But everyone doesn't care because chances are you're in the middle of a bunch of rapids and you have to get into your oar and get back to paddling. Kelly pointed out to us that the church is not just one leader. That even here, we aren't just one leader. Just on the raft, we aren't just one leader. Now, sometimes it works that you can have one appointed leader who you make the all 100% of everything, that they're responsible for everything for a certain temporary point in time. So one time I was on the river, and I was on a youth group trip. There were six or seven of us on a raft. And a guide on the back, and this guide said, okay, if you guys want to go to this really cool spot, there's a cave over if we go to this specific point on the river. And we were like, all of us were like looking at the guide, and we were like, yeah. And the guide says, okay, now in order to get over there, you have to paddle really, really hard. And he was like, can you do that? And we were like, yeah, okay. So my buddy Connor, who was in the front of the boat, me and Connor go a long ways back, and he was like, I'm going to have to paddle really hard. So he got up from the front of the boat right next to me and got himself all the way to the very, very back. And no one else paid attention to it a lot at the time. And then the guide says, okay, guys, paddle forward. And so the six rest of us kids that are ready to paddle all dig in and paddle as hard as we can. And we're all going at the same time in order to increase our speed. Well, then there's my buddy Connor in the back. Now, Connor, so I was a scrawny. I was one of the bigger scrawny kids in high school. But Connor was like that first step from being like a scrawny person or a scrawny athletic person to actually being like looking a little bit athletic. Now, this is quite deceptive because when Connor got in the zone, he could turn into an animal. There are like these big animalistic grunts that came out of him. And you're like, whoa, this is kind of scary. And Connor, in the back of this raft, started paddling twice as fast as everyone else. And he started paddling so hard, you would not believe it. And all of us, the rest of us paddling, realized really quickly, we weren't the ones moving the boat. It was Connor. He was paddling for seven people. He wasn't paddling for one. He was paddling for seven. And so it was just like, he makes these big animalistic paddles. And we were over, and in no time, we were over to that spot with the cool cave where we needed to be. And it was all Connor. Here's the thing, though. Guess what? He was tired after that. Because he just spent like a minute paddling for seven people. And this is the way it is in leadership and in church, or in the history of the people of God. That if you're going to have a lone ranger person, that it can only be for a temporary period of time. Or else, on the long run, folks start getting tired. So, some examples of these temporary ordinary leaders are like judges in the book of Judges, right? They're temporary people who God says, okay, authority in you, just go for it, man. Defeat them Canaanites. And the judge will either lone ranger beat up a bunch of Canaanites with a cattle prod, or raise up the people of Israel to go fight against the Canaanites, who, you know, apparently were a really bitter people. And so this is a good example of like a temporary leader, but also is just an ordinary person. Later on in the story of the people of God, they develop this idea that, well, we want to have a long-term person. A long-term person who's devoted to just rowing the entire boat, for taking charge of the entire situation. They do all the paddling. And you know what? That didn't work out for the people of God. After a while of paddling for everyone all day, every day, through terrible conditions, you get tired. And you can't just prioritize the whole group. At some point you get so tired that you can only realistically prioritize yourself. Have you been in that situation before? Being so tired you could only prioritize yourself? That was the only person you could think of. And too often, this is what happens when we get one single leader who's anointed with having like the full reign of something for a super, super long period of time. They just get tired. They get burnt. They're paddling for seven, but they are one. One person. On the other hand, some of the best leaders in the Bible actually have the power to paddle for seven, or paddle for 100, or paddle for 1,000. And instead, they decide to forego that super paddle power and just paddle for one. To instead make a better space for everyone to be on the boat. And make a space for everyone to paddle on the boat. Because you know what? That is a better whitewater rafting experience. It makes more camaraderie. It's more fun. It leads to more laughter on my end. You can handle way better rapids. Good examples of this is first Paul. So Paul's a Roman citizen, right? We find that out in the end of Acts at some point. And Roman citizenship in the Roman world is kind of like having the power to tell people they have to be your friend or be your slave first. And then it's also to have the power that you get to make up however much money is in your ATM account. And if people say no, you can be like, fine, you get to be my slave now and I get all your money. So really, I'm not going to stand up to a person and tell them that you don't have that much money in your ATM account because I don't want to be your slave that much. At the same time, Paul was like, he had all like the best degrees that there were around, the best education that you could find. He went to like Oxford and Harvard and all other kind of bird, Yale, Ivy, crazy league places that I hadn't even heard about before. Yet when it comes for Paul to take on his ministry, what does he do? Does he walk around being like, hey guys, I'm a Roman citizen? No. Instead, he takes up a trade as a leather worker, as a tanner, going from town to town, working an average Joe's job, a normal person's job. And he does so in order to make relationships with people, with relationships, other missionaries around him, in developing these other churches. He doesn't first come in and say, listen to me, for I am all high and mighty. He says, let's listen to each other, you and I, person to person. And hear what the gospel of God is doing amongst us. Now, if you don't think that isn't a very extreme case of giving up power to be a good leader, now let's talk about Jesus, who gives up a lot of power. Like, so a lot of people point to Jesus and be like, obviously the guy had superpowers. He could heal people, he could throw out demons and all sorts of stuff. No. Jesus did not use any superpowers. Absolutely none. Mine. Instead, Jesus is the most ordinary out of us all. He is the most human of us all by relying on God's Spirit to do those things for him. He listens to the waters, to the conditions around him, to the air. He listens to those who are around him on his paddle boat. And from there, some miraculous things happen. Remember, Jesus didn't do any of his crazy miracles out of having superpowers, but out of his own humanity. Because he wanted to show you and me that we could be the exact same way, doing the same thing. Jesus takes this one step further. He gets together all sorts of normal people to be on his paddle boat. He calls the fancy word we use for him is disciples, right? He does discipleship. And he gets these paddlers that he finds, and he picks really weird paddlers. Like, he can talk really, really well, so he can get whoever he wants to paddle with him. But instead, he gets like high school dropouts, or worse. He gets fishermen. Have you been around fishermen? Dude, they can stink sometimes. All day long, they work weird hours. He gets these two guys called the Thunder Brothers, right? That all they know how to do is be loud. That's all they do, be loud, right? And he selects them to be on his team. He selects them to be on his paddle boat. And he constructs this paddle boat so that he makes them all into expert paddlers, expert whitewater rafting guys. First, he teaches them to stay on the boat. So really good rafters, they know how to stay on the boat. Because getting off the boat, when you get off the boat, you can get in serious danger really, really fast. You can get your ankle caught on something, break it in an instant. The water can drown you. You can get hypothermia in a matter of seconds. And in just a couple of seconds more, you can find yourself a long ways away from your raft. Too far to grab from a rope or anything. You can be isolated and all alone just in a matter of seconds. Jesus also teaches his river rafting guides how to paddle hard. How to get through all the toughest rapids he knows how to navigate. All the toughest situations he can find. So that these paddlers would know how to handle the waters and the winds of life. He teaches these people also how to help other people when they get knocked out of the boat. Because at some point, everybody gets knocked out of the boat. That's the deal with whitewater rafting. You just get knocked out. So, he teaches people how to help others get back in the boat. How to get reconciled to relationships with others. By the way, if you haven't picked this up yet, I'm going to pause real quick. Where I'm getting this whitewater metaphor is that in Ephesians, Paul uses this metaphor for novice sailors, or for children in the Word of God, who get tossed asunder by the wind or by the seas. And these novice sailors can sometimes be a problem for the whole ship, this ship, if they don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to handle the ropes. They don't know how to handle the seas. And they'll often be caught off guard by storms. And once they get caught off guard by storms, you have to go through a lot of stinking work to get them back all on board. The same thing goes for whitewater rafting. Finally, Jesus makes his disciples, he makes his whitewater rafting guides to have the ability to make more guides. So he isn't the only whitewater rafting guide. There are more of them around. More of them floating down the river of life. So I got a couple of stories real quick about novices on the boat. So this one time I was floating down the river. I'd been floating a couple of times at this point. And a friend of mine brought his girlfriend along for the very first time. And Aaron, don't tell Andrew I told this story. But Andrew brought along his girlfriend who'd never been on the river before. And right at the end of a big set of rapids that we'd just gone through, with, I think it was our like first set of the day. It was tons of fun, and there was one like tiny little bump right at the end. It was so tiny I barely noticed it. And the girlfriend just like slipped right off right there. It's not the big things in life that always throw people overboard. Sometimes it's the little stuff. Or it's the stuff that's unexpected. You didn't have the capacity to see it coming. Or you didn't know to expect it in some way. It's the little stuff that throws you overboard. And so this girlfriend was so distracted. She had no idea. She got confused when she got thrown overboard. She was like, how did this happen to me? And Andrew was standing right in front of her just like not paying attention. He just didn't get what was going on. He was like tired that day. He didn't sleep well or something. And so he didn't know his girlfriend was in the water. And it was only that when I looked around and I went, oh shoot, we have to get her back in here really fast. And I ran around, grabbed her and pulled her in before anyone realized that she was down. But I knew we had to get to her as fast as we could, because she could float a long ways in a short amount of time. But what if you fill a boat with people who are novices, or maybe with people who are being immature? So I was on this one river on another youth group trip. You guys are catching the pattern here at some point. And it was my brother and a couple other youth group kids and a guy that was her first time doing this particular river. And there were a few other groups of our youth group on various boats. And it was kind of a dreary day. It wasn't perfect. Like, it was cloudy. It was just a little bit colder than normal, which means you're kind of in perpetual cold all day when you're rafting. And the water level was already pretty high. And so it got to the middle of the afternoon, and me and my group decided, okay, we're going to forget complaining. We're just going to have a good time. So we were just laughing and having a good time and taking it easy. And right as we hit this set of really heavy rapids that had just gone through a lot of change, the sprinkling that had been going on and off turned into raining cats and dogs. And I was like, whatever. We were still laughing. We were having a good time. The guide says, all right, paddle forward. So we paddle forward. And the guide says, paddle forward hard. And something clicked in my brain. I went, oh, this situation has changed. And realized that all of a sudden I wasn't in a situation where it was cool to sit around and to laugh and have a good time. But I needed to realize that I was suddenly in a life and death situation for me and my entire boat, because we weren't paying attention. We were choosing to be immature about our situation, and only at the last second did we realize that we need to start growing up really, really fast. And in those seconds, we turned out we got into a tide, a little pseudo-tide pool-looking thing in the water, and our boat started going crashing straight into a huge log that was right against the river. And instantly, right when we hit that log, we all go, ah, high side, which is code word for everyone has to jump to that side in order to get that side of the boat down, or otherwise you're going to flip. Well, guess what? That side of the boat went all the way down, almost like it was going to flip. A little bit overcorrected. So we tried to jump to the other side, and it was too late. Our boat, all of a sudden, was about to get sucked under this giant log, all of us with it, capsized. In a matter of seconds, we had to abandon our boat and jump and scramble up on top of this huge log to see our entire raft getting suctioned to the side of this log. At any second, being able to flip over the log or being flipped under the log. We had to scramble around for like 20 minutes on the dirty beach and through some trees in order to get to a spot where we could gather ourselves together as a boat, figure out what was going on. And then I believe, Aaron, was it your boat that had to pull us out? Like they had to pull our boat out of what was going on. They had to pull a rope around it and pull it as hard as they could as a team. It took them like 5 minutes or something. It was really a pain. I had to hear bad words about that the whole rest of the day. But novice or immature crew members, they aren't paying attention, they aren't working together, can be a hazard for everyone else in the boat, or can be even a hazard for the boat itself. The funny thing about spiritual maturity, of being a mature person, is it's optional. You have the ability to choose whether you are going to be mature or not in a given situation. Which, there are a lot of people I find who actually have the capacity to be mature, who have it in them, but simply choose not to. This is something I ran into all the time when I was working with street people at St. Francis. People who wanted to get something from me, and were thinking the best way to do that was to be as immature as I could in order to get that thing. And sometimes they got what they wanted. A lot of the time there were negative consequences to my relationship with that person that happened because of it. I'd say there's two critical attributes to spiritual maturity in all of us. The first is to know our authentic and our loved selves. To know Christ's work in our hearts and in our lives. To know ourselves for better or for worse. To know what things might take us down the path to our false self. So, if this isn't ringing any bells yet, we just talked about the gift of being yourself with a book by David Benner. And how that informs our own spiritual journey and our spiritual lives. If that's not sounding familiar to you, you got some sermon series or a book you got to read for a few minutes at some point. Totally great. I recommend that you review it. Second, the second attribute I think in spiritually mature people is spiritually mature people know their mission. They know their end game. The Greek uses the word andros teleos, which means a man of purpose. Or a man of ends. We have to know what our mission is. Not just as a church, but individually. Here at Grace, we talk a lot about love God, love people, serve joyfully. In many ways, that is a very specific mission, but that's also a very broad mission for each and every one of us. And so we need to take the time in our hearts and our lives to figure out how are we shaping our lives according to that vision, according to that mission. How are we individually, what are the finite, specific things that we are doing to love God, love people, and serve joyfully in our hearts and in our lives? What are we doing on a Monday afternoon about that? What are we doing on a Tuesday? So many of us, it's easy to think about what we're doing about that on a Sunday morning, but what about the rest of our week? What are the specific things we are doing the rest of our lives to complete that mission? Where has God uniquely called and gifted you to go? What position are you serving on the boat? Along with those two attributes, I'd say there's two skills. The first skill is the how over what. I kind of already hinted at this. So mature people go about relationships in a way where they care more about the how they're going about the relationship than the what they're getting out of it. So on the inverse, immature people might talk to a person and think just about the what. I just want to get what I want from Kelly. I just want to get what I want from Kelly. I just want to get what I want from Kelly. And not thinking about the how I'm doing that. Is the how I'm doing that producing a good relationship between the two of us? Is the how I'm doing that producing a fruitful relationship between the two of us? Are we kind of standing, trading water or standing normal? Or am I harming the relationship between us and me getting what I want? By the way, getting what you want, the what strategy can be far more efficient in getting what you want, right? It's far more efficient. Whereas the how, as you grow in maturity, becomes less and less of a question. It's like, I only care about the how, man. I'm only caring about the how we get the how our relationship grows together. And if I don't get the what I want, the how is going to take priority. At the same time, there's people who do on the immature scale. There's people who do this all the time. Where I mean, I try and talk to Tim, and I'm trying to pretend immature, right? And so we start talking and talking, and I want to get what I want, but he isn't giving me for some reason. It might be a perfectly good reason, by the way. And so I get frustrated, and some of my immaturities start coming out, because I never act like an immature person. So what I want to do is I want to make sure I feel good about myself, because I know I got some immaturities, there's some spiritual immaturities that are coming out of myself. So the first thing I do to reconcile that is I run all the way over here to my superintendent, and I say, Chris, I've got this situation here, and I am being so mature about it. Now, raise hands real quick if you think my demonstration here is truly me being really mature. Okay, I hope those are sarcastic, non-harm hand raises. But at the same time, this is something we do all the time. In order to feel good about ourselves or feel good about where we are in our journey or feel good about our own immaturity, to go to someone else to triangulate them in or to just vent or something like that. Or just pin all the immaturities onto someone else and make sure someone's on our side to know that. Instead, mature people are going to do the best that they can. I try and do the best I can. I don't always do it, by the way. Of focusing purely on owning up to what I'm doing wrong. Of trying to find where my own immaturities are. The problem with that is it requires listening to my own heart. It means listening specifically to the parts of my own heart that I don't like very much. It means knowing how it is with my soul. The second skill that is definitely quite interrelated to this is just the skill of paying attention. It's paying attention to your outer world, paying attention to your inner world. When I was on that boat that I was apparently trying to flip, I was not paying attention to my outer world. I wasn't paying attention that all of a sudden the conditions had radically changed. I also wasn't paying attention to the fact that I wasn't tuning into that. I wasn't paying attention to the fact that I was tired, I was hungry, and I wasn't paying attention to the fact that I wasn't being vigilant. I needed to tune into my own soul, and I needed to tune into the environment around me. And tuning into the environment around you, I think we are all called to a place of unity with Christ. To be one with the great river guide. To be one with the river. To be one with the streams and the rapids of life. Mature Christians don't practice only unity through Christ, they practice unity like Christ. Means that Jesus had this unique power or unique ability to just hang out with God. Jesus didn't go for all-nighter prayer retreats just to be like, I want a new Amazon Prime. I want a new vending machine. I want some stinking better paddlers or some stinking better disciples. They just aren't good enough for me. Jesus didn't sit around complaining about those things all the time. Instead, Jesus chose to simply hang out, simply be with God. To allow to have a unity of will with God. To experience God's unity, own resonance within his soul and within his heart. For myself, the experience of this personal unity has become a critical and a core practice. I take a few minutes every day. Ideally 10, sometimes it's 5. To sit there and to be silent. To wait upon the Lord. Say, Lord, oh Lord, may I have unity with you in my heart and in my life. May I know where you are in the winds around me, in the waters underneath my feet, in the rapids and the water that sometimes overflows me. Why should you care about biblical leadership? I'd say it's pretty simple. Biblical leadership is about growing and cultivating spiritual maturity. Do you want to click the slide right there, Philip? So, I skipped one. That's why I needed the slide. First, it's about knowing, having people who can handle the rivers and the waters of life. That together, we can all be good paddlers, is what biblical leadership is all about. That together, there aren't slackers among us, but we can all take care of each other on our boat and go where we are called to go on the river. That we don't get drowned by crazy rapids, and that we're paying attention and have unity with the world around us. We have unity with each other because we all have unity with God. When we all have unity with God, that puts us all pretty close on the same page. Finally, we develop spiritually mature leaders. Jesus took nobodies, high school dropouts, people society didn't think was that cool, and turned them into spiritually mature people who could handle leadership each in their own way and in their own light or right. Each of them empowered and fueled by God's holy power himself, just as we are, fueled by God's holy love for each of us. Finally, I strongly argue that biblical leadership is at its core about unity, about us being one body of Christ together, who are all unified and that because we are all one with Christ himself, that we are all one with God. It's a lot easier way of putting each other on the same page than trying to sign contracts or agree to specific agreements. If we choose to have one unity with God, we will find ourselves closer to one another, and we will find ourselves closer unto ourselves. This morning, as we head towards communion, which I think is awesome, I ask you to think about this for a second. Do you really want to grow in maturity as a leader? Answer that honestly. Maybe in respect to a certain thing, you don't want to grow in maturity as a leader. It's easy to say yes in general, but when it comes to this specific thing, at the same time, I'd encourage you to open up your heart to experience unity with God. Where is God's personal heart and God's personal resonance in your life? How does that feel inside your body, inside your mind, inside your soul? That is what biblical leadership is all about.